South Dakota rodeo is captivating the nation, but only after Jeremiah Murphy turned his camera on the riders. From SDPB, today is Thursday, October 23rd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome the photographer who documents the dust and grit of the rodeo arena. We'll talk about the connection between art and injury as we explore his work, and we'll ask why the New Yorker magazine wanted to feature his images. That's coming a bit later in the hour. But first, grandparents, take note. You might want to shop early for holiday toys this year. We'll talk toys and tariffs with shop owners on both sides of the river. It might not be the prices that matter most this year. It might be what's not on the shelves that causes the disruption. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. As the holiday shopping season approaches, business owners are bracing for the impact of import tariffs. Many toys and gifts sold in the U.S. are made overseas, meaning rising costs could affect both retailers and families, or they could not. So SDPB's Jackson Dirk went visiting with retailers in South Dakota to learn how business owners are adapting and what changes mean for shoppers this season. Here's his conversation with Zanbro's variety owner, Jeff Danz.
The owner of Zanbro's Variety says as part of the gift-giving industry, the store is seeing negative impacts of higher costs due to import taxes or tariffs. Jeff Danz says tariffs are driving prices up.
And then you couple that with the increasing cost of shipping the last couple of years, and particularly this year. You start looking at an invoice for merchandise, and the tariffs and the freight are adding as much as 30 to 40% of the cost of that merchandise. And for a lot of merchandise, there's just not that much room to increase the price. And so what happens is the retailer, us, starts cutting our margins. And we can't do that forever.
He says he's told buyers not to purchase from overseas vendors that are increasing prices drastically.
We're trying to find alternative sources. And we're trying to buy more from American manufacturers and vendors.
Proponents say that's part of the goal of tariffs, strengthen the U.S. by bringing manufacturing and other industries back to American soil. Proponents say it might be a good thing companies are forced to look stateside for goods. Danz doesn't dispute there are some positives to working with U.S. vendors, but it's not perfect from his business's standpoint.
During COVID, we started to see a lot of young entrepreneurs designing and printing letterpress cards and making products by hand, craftsmanship. But it's not nearly on the level of what in the past we've been able to source from other countries.
Danz adds the constant changes have made it hard to project product costs or decide when to buy from vendors. He points specifically to the volatility of tariffs on Chinese products. He says Zanbro's Variety and other downtown Sioux Falls shops have had to stock up on toys to avoid potential prices spiking.
Sometimes that's difficult to do, to buy your holiday toy inventory in the spring or in the summer. And that's what most of us have been doing. And we've been fortunate that we have had the cash flow to accommodate that, but not everybody did.
He says now they're beginning to see the available toy inventory reflect increased tariff prices. He speculates what consumers might do around Christmas time if Chinese tariffs continue.
There may be a smaller selection of particular toys in the marketplace. That will be an interesting thing to see, but I think people can adapt to that, and maybe there'll be fewer toys for gifts. Maybe there'll be more books for kids, encouraging reading. I don't know, but that's one thing to watch, is what happens with the Christmas toy inventory.
Danz adds that one of the most frustrating things his store has encountered is what happens with packages from overseas when they do purchase internationally.
Purchase from a lot of small stationery lines, and some of them are in England and shipped from London, and they get stuck in customs. And what we're experiencing is that we have an order that's sitting in customs, and it's been there for 6 weeks because the vendor hasn't responded to answer the questions that customs has about where was it manufactured and that sort of thing. And they keep contacting us, and we Kelvin, we don't have that information. You have to talk to the vendor, and the vendor is not responding, so that product's sitting there.
He says package delays in customs isn't a new thing this year. He blames more recent challenges on an executive order President Trump signed earlier this summer that put an end to a decades-old customs exemption that made some international shipping easier. That exemption, called de minimis, was introduced in 1938 and granted some international packages, under a certain price threshold, an exemption from paying certain duties, fees, and other taxes like tariffs. That price threshold was $800 as of 2016. President Trump said he ended the provision because the lower security measure applied to de minimis packages allowed overseas shippers to bring fentanyl and other synthetic opioids into the U.S. He also called the provision a, quote, trade loophole. However, according to Danz, it caused some disruptions in the shipping process.
All of that ended, and literally hundreds of thousands of packages sat in customs, and had to be sorted out.
However, he says it's a good thing rates appear to be stable for the moment.
It's the unknown that, hopefully, the unknown period of what to expect with tariffs and the impact on getting it out of customs is a lot clearer now because the vendors have a better idea. But for a while, the people in customs were in confusion.
That's SDPB's Jackson Dirks. This is an ongoing story, of course, and you can find more of his reporting on the impact of tariffs in South Dakota at sdpb.org/news. After the break, we check in on the west side of the state with Who's Toy House. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Trade policy can feel far away from Main Street, but for small business owners, it can shape what's on the shelves and how much families pay this holiday season. Tariffs on imported goods are rippling through the toy industry, affecting manufacturers, retailers, and parents searching for that perfect gift. Summer Kingsbury knows the impact firsthand. She is owner of Who's Toy House in Rapid City. It's a locally loved store that specializes in imaginative play and quality craftsmanship. She joined us from the SDPB Black Hill Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City for a conversation about how tariffs influence pricing, product availability, and the way she runs her independent shop in South Dakota. Thanks so much for walking down the street and saying hi to us here at In the Moment, Summer.
Well, thank you for having me.
I have spent some time in your store when I'm out the Rapid City way, and it is, of course, delightful. Tell me a little bit about your shop and how long it's been in operation.
Absolutely. We're a locally owned and operated toy store in downtown Rapid City, located right next to Main Street Square. My husband has Who's Hobby House, which has been in our family for three generations and just celebrated their 75th anniversary this summer.
Wow.
And our store is going to turn 14 years old next month.
Tell us a little bit about why you wanted to open it and the time frame that you did, what some of the pressures were at that time that you were facing when you opened.
Well, you know, a lot of the pressures that we have, part of it was that we wanted to be involved in the revitalization of the Main Street Square. That was really important to us. We at the time, 15 years ago, downtown wasn't as beautiful as it is now, and so there were a lot of working parts and a lot of helping hands, and we just wanted to be part of that because it was important to us.
Yeah, part of that revitalization effort, why toys? Why a family shop?
Well, one of the things that we noticed in downtown Rapid City was that while we would have quite a few kids into our hobby store, there weren't a lot of activities for young families and children downtown. Mm-hmm. And so having a toy store, we thought that would really widen that audience to be able to welcome families to downtown.
All right. Tell us a little bit about your mission today. What kinds of toys do you stock and offer for families?
Well, you know, I always say if you have a good toy store, you should have something for everyone. It's not a certain age group. There's something for everyone there. I like smart toys. I like toys that make you think a little bit. The differences between the toy store and the hobby store is generally most items will be ready to play with out of the package. Yes, you're going to assemble a Lego set, but it's ready to play with out of the package, where there's a little bit more to it at the hobby store, a little bit more, we'll say, construction, so to speak.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what kids are into right now. What's popular?
You know, I would say probably one of the biggest things we hear this time of year is so many of our customers have real concerns about their children at a young age spending too much time on screens. So primarily we focus on screen-free toys.
Give me an example of what a screen-free toy is that would engage, you know, an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely. We have Shishibus. They're shape-shifting boxes. They're magnetic, and you can make 70 shapes out of them. And so you'll consider those to be like an origami type style, but there's no loose pieces. It takes that fidgeting component that the kids like to fidget with, but parents like it because there's no loose pieces and it's just a fun shape. But the more you collect and the more you acquire, the larger shapes you can make.
Yeah. So when people come in and ask for a birthday present, or they're getting ready for the holiday season, and they ask you to find something that fits a particular age group, talk a little bit about the importance of customer service in the toy market.
Oh, absolutely. For customer service, we just think it's really important. If we're doing our job, the customer is happy, but so is the person that's receiving the gift. We want to make sure that it's the right price point. We also want to make sure that it fits the needs of the child that's receiving it, but also the needs of the family. It's different if you have a child that is the fifth child in that family. They're not going to need the basic items. So usually what we'll refer people to are arts and crafts or bath items, something that has a limited life.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the economy now, some of the pressures you might be feeling as a small business owner, whether that's with health insurance or tariffs, or what are some of the pressures and how are you responding to them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this has probably been the biggest year where we've had to pivot, even more so than COVID for us, just simply because there are a lot of components that come into that. Generally, when we purchase and when we design our store for the holidays, I do that in February. And during February, if you would think back earlier in the year, that's when people were just starting to talk about tariffs and the possibility of them. And so many vendors weren't really sure what their production was going to look like. And so a lot of those companies that have taken hits during COVID couldn't really gamble to produce a large amount of inventory this year. So a lot of items that we intended on bringing in for fourth quarter aren't being produced. They've held off production until next year, until the market can somewhat stabilize. The thing that's important for people to remember is an item can be made in the USA, but there can be one component of that item that could be made in a country which has tariffs. Mm-hmm. And that affects the production of that item and also the cost.
Yeah. So shortages, do you think, will it get that bad where people are maybe need to think about shopping early?
I would say I anticipate there will be some shortfalls this year. As a business owner, I've tried to stock inventory earlier in the year because I didn't anticipate that I would be able to order it later in the year. So this year, As a business owner, I am carrying a lot more inventory and stocked a little bit heavier than I generally would and a little bit earlier.
Yeah. Are you seeing trends in, numbers on the daily? Are people still buying?
Yeah, people are still buying. And I think it will be interesting to see if the grandparent that has three grandchildren that normally buys three gifts for them, is she going to spend the same amount or is she going to buy the same amount of toys and spend less? It's too early to say.
Yeah. Prices are holding steady or are they going up a little bit?
They are going up a little bit, but buying early has enabled us to keep our prices down a little bit more this year at Christmas, that possibly will be rising after the first of the year.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite? I know that you have a Brio special going on in October, and that was one of my daughter's favorite things, was those little Brio train sets. We have the whole set at home now, and she's all grown up, but I... I still treasure it. Yeah,
I would say I would say probably the thing I'm seeing more this year is that people are shopping maybe a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Maybe you're going to spend the same amount, but you're budgeting it a little bit earlier. Our Brio sale is always a big it's a big showstopper for us because that's when the biggest sets are usually going out the door for Christmas or birthdays. And this year, we're actually seeing more of them go out. And I think it's people taking advantage of the sale, just wanting to make sure that they're able to fit all their needs during the Christmas holiday.
Yeah. With all the tariff conversation and politics and the economic uncertainties here, there in manufacturing, it seems like a lot of people can still get behind shopping local. Tell us a little bit about why that matters, that people show up at a local toy store versus maybe ordering something online. How does that make a difference in the local economy?
Yeah, it's huge. The thing that a lot of people, especially if you're not in retail, you maybe aren't aware of, the reason they call it Black Friday is because it's for big box, it's not until that Friday when you're in the black. The rest of the year, you're running at a deficit. So when you're looking at that fourth quarter, that is when you're making your money for the next year. And so that being said, it's a lot of pivoting. It's a lot of running numbers. It's a lot of guesswork. I think the huge thing about shopping local, there's never going to be a time where you can purchase absolutely everything you need local. There are some times when we do need to order something that might not be available in our local community, and that's okay. But supporting local when you can is so important. It's a community connection.
Summer Kingsbury, anything else that you wanted to add that I didn't ask you?
No, I mean, yeah. I would just say one of the things is that sometimes, you know, just come down and see what downtown businesses have to offer. There are so many great businesses, not just the toy store, not just the hobby store. There's a ton of brand new businesses downtown, and this is an opportunity for you to support them. And just making one purchase at one downtown business at Christmas makes a huge difference in your community. And we're able to support those things and bring people together.
That's Summer Kingsbury, owner of Who's Toy House in Rapid City. She joined us to talk about how tariffs are affecting the toy industry, from global supply chains to the toy aisle right here at home. After the break, we will hear from celebrated rodeo photographer Jeremiah Murphy. His photographs have landed in the New Yorker magazine. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. If you have been around South Dakota's rodeo scene, you have likely seen Jeremiah Murphy. He's a photographer known for his striking photos that capture the action in the arena. We know him here at home, and now so does the rest of the country. Jeremiah Murphy's work was featured in The New Yorker. He stopped by our studios in Rapid City. Jeremiah Murphy, welcome to In the Moment. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited about this.
And a lot of people across the nation who don't know you as well as South Dakotans know you are about to know at least something about you, which is your work as a photographer, because the New Yorker has picked up your photographs. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with the New Yorker and that process.
My relationship with the New Yorker is brand new and just an absolute treat. And how we got there was really fun. Our son Hunter, our oldest son Hunter, he develops brands. He lives in Salt Lake, and Hunter has a friend, a photographer from Montana, Will Warasilla, and Hunter was showing some of my photographs to his friend Will. Will said, "Hey, I know a photo editor at the New Yorker, and I think she'd really get a kick out of these." Hunter sent those on to my new friend Stacy Pittman in New York. She was very enthused about them and a real advocate for this project. And then Stacy brought in a writer, Casey Sepp, who was just terrific. She's a staff writer at the New Yorker. She's published a really interesting book called Furious Hours, which is about Harper Lee. And in any event, they put Casey together with me. We had about a two-hour phone call, and the result is what you see there. So, but it all started with my son. So that that's a lot of fun.
And before we get into this, the New Yorker is famous for having fact checkers. Were you fact checked on all your memories of your life and in photography?
boy, was I! yeah, that I kind of look forward to that. You know, I've been a in the one sense, I go way back with the New Yorker. My grandmother, Jean Foy, gave me a subscription when I was 12, and I've had a subscription ever since. So I'm familiar with the fact checkers, and in fact, this is their 100th anniversary, and they did a really sort of interesting article on the other day. But I mentioned this to your friend Kevin Wooster, and Kevin contributed a couple of quotes to an article on Thune that the New Yorker did recently, and I think he said he got two or three calls from them just over a few sentences. So I thought. And honestly, my grandfather had a saying: "Never spoil a good story for want of a few facts." And I might be, I might be in that mold. And I thought, how are they going to fact check just my sort of random gibberish? As it turned out, it was really interesting, and it was more than a fact check call. There were context questions, and does this fit, and does that fit? But every time she would say to me. And it would always kind of start like this. She'd say, now Casey quoted you as saying, and she'd start speaking. And I always felt like I was in the witness chair, you know. Did you really say this? Yeah. Dumb as it sounds, that's what I said.
Was anything revealed during the fact-checking process that you think, oh, yeah, I'm really glad that didn't make it into print because people in South Dakota would have laughed at that? Because they'd be like, no, that's not, they got that wrong.
Well, yes, there were several of those sorts of things, and
that's why they check.
Yeah, and kind of they rounded the corners and made the joints smooth and made things make sense, so that yeah. Obviously, what you don't want is somebody to look at that and go, who does know rodeo and does know ranching and all that, and go, well, they don't know what they're talking about. So we brought all, there were some little things, and it all came into line very nicely.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk more about Casey's writing here in a minute, but first let's talk about these images. Because I know your work to a certain extent. I follow you on, you know, Facebook. I've seen things before, but seeing them all in context like this, it's really quite astonishing, the body of work. And this is only a small excerpt of it. What was it like selecting and curating the images that might end up in this piece, which is called The Guts and Glory of Indian Rodeo in The New Yorker, published on October 6th online, and I'm not sure which print issue it's in, but it's out now.
It is, and that choosing process, that editing process is, it's a big part of it, and it's challenging because you want to get it right. And you know, there's a truism in writing and editing your writing, and I think they say, you know, kill your babies. And some of that applies here, where it's just this photo or that photo that was just one of my favorites. It's like, I don't know if this works. And I worked with Hunter, my son, on that, who's a graphic designer.
Yeah.
And he was a great help. And it's just great to have, you almost need a second pair of eyes to sort of keep you honest and or bring in some other information. And we wound up with what we thought was a really good collection, and of what we submitted and what they asked for, virtually everything wound up in the piece. So we guessed well, I think.
And this first image, it really takes, you know, a few hundred words to explain what a wild horse race is. This is a picture that you say you got injured in. Tell us a little story about, for radio listeners, about this first image where there's a lot happening in here. I mean, I think she says, like, hats are flying, boots are dug in. She's a wonderful description of it. Oh, here it is. A black and white Bruegel. Sorry, yeah. What's a Bruegel?
Bruegel is among the various over-the-top compliments, that's one. He was a 16th century Flemish painter.
So
it's the New Yorker, right?
Yeah. this image has everything: horse rearing, men cowering, hats flying, boots dragging, and hoofs trampling. Somehow it captures even the senses it technically can't, from the sound of clanging chutes and slamming gates to the taste of blood and dirt and the smell of cigarette smoke and cow. Can't say that word on the radio. Wow, Casey, nice writing. But that's a good description of the picture. You tell me a little bit about making this picture.
It's a wonderful and a generous description of that picture, and she gets a lot of the job done. It's funny, I've wanted to put something together in photography for a while, and one of the things I would sort of joke about this, but I'm serious, is I'd say I want to go on Laurie Walsh's show and talk about pictures, because it's impossible. I want to go on radio and talk about pictures.
We needed Casey to give us some of the words.
Yes.
And here we are.
Absolutely. So that's part of the fun here, but this picture, I think it's a great representation of a wild horse race, because it's sort of like everything is going on all at once. You see two people on the left of the frame, and it might not be evident, but the person closest to the horse on the rope is a woman. That's a team of two men and a woman. Their teammate is on his back and sort of reaching up, and he's desperate. He is under the back hooves, or nearly under the back hooves, of two different horses. His hat has flown off about 20 or 30 feet distant and about 15 or 20 feet high. There's dust everywhere. And what I really love about it is the light. The light in Rosebud is really something. And I can't, beyond just sort of knowing it's special, it's hard to say beyond that, but there were thunderheads overhead, sort of broken up. The light reflects off the bottom of some of those, and you get a particular quality in this photo that the way the dust and everything comes up, it's just everything came together really nicely. And I haven't, among the photos you've seen, you've never seen that one. Because it almost scared me it was so good. And I feared I wouldn't edit it well, and I took a lot of time at that. So it's just kind of like there's a riot going on, you know, with horses and people and ropes and all of that. Now, you had mentioned the injury, and the injury didn't happen. The injury had happened the subsequent year. This photo was taken in 2018, but that scene, if you look at that photo, one thing that happens in wild horse races is that horses will get away pretty quick. The horses have a huge advantage, and invariably, if there are, say, five or six teams, one of those horses will get away quick. I have a rule, and it's dangerous in there. And so my rule is pretty straightforward. When the first horse breaks loose, I'll be out at the edge of things in the arena, but when the first horse breaks loose, I head for the fence and get up the fence and out of the way. And I was down in Rosebud one day in 2019, and there was a wild horse race, and it was just spectacular. And the action was so good, like a little kid, I broke my rule, and now I'm kind of making my way around the arena, and I'm all the way to the other end, and I can recall distinctly the shot I was trying to get, and these two guys were wrestling with this horse. It was backlit, and I knew the horse was going to rear. You can just kind of tell, and there was dust everywhere, and I knew what was going to come together, and I was waiting to get it. And the next thing I remember is a bullfighter, Maurice Vasu, had me by the belt, and he's dragging me to the edge, to the fence. He's like, "Murphy, you have to get the beep up, and we got to get out of here." And I'm just stunned. I'd been run over, and as it turned out, he gets me to the fence, and that was the last event of the day. It typically is. So I'm making my way along the fence toward my car. It's a high, you know, around rodeos, it's a 6 or 7 foot high fence, and I am really in some pain. And I get to the end of that fence, and I've got 100 yards or so to get to my car and up a gentle hill, and I thought, and I'm trying to get going, and two women come by. And they said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Oh," I started to say, you know, "Oh, yeah, 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 I'm sure." And I just said, "No, I'm not all right. And can we help you?" And I said, I said, "Yeah, I could use some help." It was two women, Bobby Vandenhoek and Lisa Colombe. And I had an arm over each of their, you know, and they were on either side of me, and I had my arms over their shoulders, and they got me to my car. And they said, are you sure you're all right? And once I was sitting down, I was fine. And they said a little prayer over me, which was really the nicest thing among a number of nice things they did for me that day. And I got in my car and drove to Rapid. I got to the ER. I was comfortable as long as I was sitting. I got to the ER in Rapid, and I had to call the ER and say, "Hi, I'm
in the car. Jeez.
I'm in a red Honda out here in the parking lot." And they sent a big burly nurse out, and he was great, and he grabs me. Several people grabbed me by the belt that day. He grabbed me by the belt and pulled me out of the car and into a wheelchair, and they took me into the hospital, and they said, "Well, you cracked your pelvis, and there's nothing you can do but go easy. And they really did. They gave me a pair of crutches and a jar of pain pills, and I had to just take it easy for a few weeks. So that's my dumb. I had a guy, Cole Waters, told me once. He's a stock contractor down Pine Ridge. He said, "You'll never be a real rodeo photographer, Murphy, until you get schmucked down." Well, I got schmucked down.
Yeah.
That is that big, beautiful picture, and that's what happened a year subsequent.
That's a great story. All right, so the picture is from 2018. The injury is 2019. But I want to go back to something you said about the 2018 picture, which is that you were afraid you couldn't edit it well.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on there?
Well, I don't edit much in terms of, I don't really change anything. In case you mentioned in the piece, the only thing I'll take out of a photo are dust spots that are actually on my filter. You know, they're not part of the picture. They get on my filter. And I think she also got the point in there and we're always trying to avoid that in backgrounds. You want to keep outhouses out of the backgrounds, but everything else is in there. But in terms of the editing, to get those grays, to get that shading, if you look at the way the sun comes through the horse's legs and there's different tones, that's the stuff you want to get just right. And this started so nice, I didn't want my clumsy hand and eye to mess it up. I did very little with it. It was a light touch, but it just, I was so tickled with that. Like I say, it was almost intimidating to get it right. And then I got it as right as I can.
That's an interesting artistic problem to discuss when you're intimidated by your own moment, right? Like, am I up for this? And so I want to go back off that kind of thought to your first camera and your first pictures. And when did you get a camera placed in your hand and decide this was something that was more than just a little fun? Like, when did you start taking it seriously?
Well, I took it seriously in high school and college. The first camera I ever used, my dad had this, it was a Mamiya-Flex twin lens reflex camera. And just picture, it's the kind of a camera you had to look down into like a brownie, but with vastly better lenses. And it had the viewfinder in top, and you would sort of turn this crank on the side to focus it. It's a real machine. It's a beautiful machine. In fact, my dad gave it to Hunter. Years ago, Hunter was visiting. He was a student at State College, and he went to visit his grandparents one day, and my dad was showing him different stuff, and Hunter was just really enjoying that camera as a beautiful machine, and Dad said, "Well, you should just have it." And so Hunter still has that camera, but in any event, I had that, and I wasted a bunch of film, and I wasted a bunch of my dad's money down at Harold's, and my folks got me my own camera. They got me a 35mm Pentax for Christmas when I think I was a sophomore. And then that's when I got serious. And then when I was college age, I would take pictures in. I'd go to bars. I went to the Pomp Room a lot, and you'd shoot bands there. And eventually I moved to Los Angeles, and, you know, cooler bands, cooler bars, and I kind of did that. I was a hobbyist, but I guess a serious hobbyist, and I would print my own stuff. They had rental dark rooms in Los Angeles in the 80s, which is a cool thing. And moved back to South Dakota with Kaya after Hunter was born. We had two more kids. Took a lot of soccer and volleyball and track and field and football. And that was great. And, you know, but honestly, with this, I ratcheted it up kind of at the same time. I talk about in there, my first rodeo was the old Crazy Horse Rodeo. They don't do it anymore, unfortunately. But I went to that and I thought I was just drawn in. And that was, I looked this morning, that was 138 rodeos ago. And so I've been developing my craft a lot, I think, at the same time I've been developing this interest in rodeos.
So what year would that have been, do you think?
Well, that was 15 years ago. So
15 years ago. Okay.
2010, right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. But motion. From the bands to the soccer to the, you know, the athletics that your kids are part of in immediately, because photographers can become obsessed with various subject matters.
Mm-hmm.
For you, it's got to be in motion.
Yeah. Motion, action, you know, my best band. Well, I had, and this was the fun of living in Los Angeles. One night I went, we lived just two blocks from a place called Club Lingerie on Sunset Boulevard, which was just a good, solid, you know, rock and roll club, and the Blasters would play down there and Los Lobos and bands like that. And one night there was a band playing, they were called Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs, and he said, we've got a guest tonight we want to bring in for you and sing a couple of songs, and it was Tom Waits.
Oh, wow.
And I'll fight anybody who says they're a bigger Tom Waits, which is a terrible way to put it. But anyway, and there was Tom Waits, and you had to bracket everything then because, you know, you're shooting in a dark bar. He's spotlit, so there's this white face that takes up maybe 10% of the frame and 90% is darkness. And so, you know, you shoot one frame at 1/250th and one at 1/125th, and you're tweaking stuff. And I got a couple of happy accidents with him where it's actually kind of blurry, but it's if you know Tom Waits, you go, yeah. Oh, yeah, there it is. And, yeah, of course, with sports, that's all action. And rodeo, there's so much action, it'll just make you crazy. And there's also faces. There's also people and characters, right. And I'm really drawn to that.
Yeah, because when you mention Tom Waits and I look at the rodeo pictures here in The New Yorker, I mean, there are a lot of character faces. There's lines, there's expressions, there's youth, but there's injury, there's pain. There's humor. What are you looking at through the viewfinder? Because are you capturing the expressions accidentally because you're looking at the motion in the horse and trying not to get hurt? Like how are you making some of the decisions that you're making so that not everything is a happy accident? A lot of this is really skill, developed skill.
If a lot of it's just practice. And I'll be honest, I'm not great at capturing a bronc rider at the absolute moment. I can do it, but boy, I miss a lot, you know, because there's different horses have different rhythms, different, you know. So you just do it, and you just keep doing it. And so some of it is that, is I'm looking for that horse at a certain point, and I'll come back later and go, wow, that guy had that amazed expression or that big grin because he knows, you know, he's going to get a high score. And then there's other shots when it's kind of quieter. I remember very distinctly there's a shot in there where there's a stock contractor, there's a horse who has one leg over the edge of the chute. It's a chute where they bring the horses in before they get in front of the riders. And this horse has just said to heck with it. And his right leg is up and over the edge of the chute.
Yeah.
And there are two women, one with these sort of Audrey Hepburn sunglasses on top of her head. And they're tugging at the horse's mane. Mm-hmm. And the horse is just sort of looking off like, I don't even, it's really fun. And that was a real slow moment. And I saw, you just saw everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes you look and you go, oh, there we go.
Yeah.
So it can be, it can range from kind of a, you're in the middle of a havoc and later you figure what you got to other quieter moments. And it's like, that's cool. I want to capture that.
I think Casey does a great job, the writer of this piece, at pointing out that these pictures are not romanticized. They're not precious. They're not, mm-hmm. you know, so tell me a little bit about your philosophy, but they're also not gratuitously cool. You know, like, do you know what I'm saying there? She says it better. Yeah.
No, I think I do. And I, And she talks in there, too, about how I don't kind of do the typical, the postcard image. The,
right, yeah.
There are great people doing that, and those are great images to have, and there are some wonderful photographers doing that. I probably can't express it well. I look for stuff in the edges. I look just a little off to the side, you know, kind of like driving down the highway and you're at dusk and you're keeping an eye on the ditches for deer. And that's what I'm looking for here, is to take away something unusual. And I'll go to a rodeo and pull up in the parking lot and I'll just about grin, because you just know there's all this material in front of you. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it can feel selfish. It's like, oh, this is for me. Well, no, of course it isn't, dummy. But there is so much going on, and so many people and so many characters. And some of my shots are just the good old, man, that horse's legs are outstretched front and back, and the rider's perfectly in sync. And it's a picture you would have seen 100 years ago. But others are a little different. And it's difficult to explain what I'm looking for, other than that what I put down on paper and say, here's what I saw.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of at the end of the day, that's what this is I'm saying to you, here's what I saw that I thought you might get a kick out of, the viewer.
Here's what I saw. You might get a kick out of it. Here's what Casey says, and I want to ask you about this. Baseball is America's pastime and football America's sport, but rodeo may as well be America itself. Cowboys alongside clowns, raw courage along with pure idiocy, a never-ending tug of war between sincerity and spectacle, myth and reality. Which brings us to this idea of these pictures and what it says. What does rodeo say about America? What does it say about South Dakota? What does it say about who we are in our relationship with each other? You agree with her there? Is this look at America?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was fair. And I love that passage. And
just good sports writing. Yeah,
it is. And I think she gets a lot. And I think there is a lot to that. You know, it's sort of interesting, because it's people who are self-chosen because they enjoy either engaging in or watching that sport. So that's what brings us all to that arena, is we want to see a good show and/or we want to put on a good ride, you know, and/or we want to put on a ride that's going to get us some money that'll help make our way to the national finals. Mm-hmm. The politics are generally conservative. This is Western South Dakota. There will be rodeo clowns. Traditionally, will make political jokes and that sort of thing, but they're sort of the dumbest, lamest. The politics is there, but it's sort of off to the side. The there will be there will be an anthem. The rodeo queens will come out with various flags, the U.S. flag, tribal flag, stuff like that. Typically, there will be a tribal honoring song,
yeah.
And a real strong acknowledgement of that culture and where we are. And then everybody's kind of looking to see a horse buck, looking to see a girl rope a calf in, 0.0 seconds, that sort of thing. And so we're just there doing that.
Yeah.
And then I think the things, the points that Casey makes and how all that comes together, and it is crazy. And there are clowns, and there are incredibly talented athletes. And I think she describes it, verbally as well as I can.
And some of what we're doing is really stupid. This is a really bad idea. Everybody's going to get hurt. There's nothing safe about this.
No, those bulls, if you look at old, and you guys do a nice job, you have a few films up on your website and that you broadcast of rodeos, say, like in the 50s or 40s. Look at those bulls, and look at the bulls and horses and my pictures. And frankly, from here, if you look at the bulls and horses at the national final rodeos, it's like looking at an NFL player today versus one in 1955. The animals are faster and stronger, and the riders, though, still seem to be about 150-pound, skinny ranch hands.
And you get to know people. You get to know folks.
Oh, yeah.
And you've also, say that you might be photographing them at the worst moment of their life, because some people do get hurt permanently. So tell me a little bit about your relationship with people when they see you get out of the car. What are they saying?
People are just really nice to. I am well treated at rodeos, and I think that's because it's kind of generally folks' nature. And yeah, I've gotten to know a lot of people. There's a family element to it. There are generations of families. You know, the Waters, the Vasus, the long breaks go back forever with bronc bucking. Marty Jandro, who now is a judge, was a champion back in the 70s, and so there's history there, and there's families and all of that, and so I'm well treated. I work very hard to stay out of the way. My one idiotic incident notwithstanding, I really try to make myself invisible. There's a lot going on behind the chutes where I am. And what I do, I share my pictures, and I think that I suspect that helps my treatment. Because I'll put stuff up on Facebook and people enjoy them, and I'll try to tag people when I know who it is, and so that helps the relationship quite a bit. But before any of that, I just you're well treated there. You treat people well in rodeo, and my experience is they'll treat you well.
You're giving something back. Because they get to see, they don't see this. I mean, it happens so fast, they don't even know.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't even know what happened. And they remember the ride might have been good, but then they see the image and they have something.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, so there's there's some give and take in the relationship. But frankly, like with a lot of things, you know, if you show somebody you're interested in what they're doing and curious about it, they're generally with you.
Yeah. What's next for you?
More of the same.
Books, exhibitions. Do you do shows?
That is in this regard. Yes, that's okay. Next. And yeah. Hunter and I are working on some stuff. And this is as good a stepping off point. I mean, I'm just incredibly lucky to have this happen. And now, yes, I want to take advantage of this and kind of leverage that and put some of my prints in people's hands and get them hanging on some walls that people can come see.
Is the rodeo alive and well? What's the future of this sport, especially in South Dakota, especially in reservation, in tribal country?
Exactly. I worry about rodeo. There'll always be the big rodeos, I think. They will fill the Stanford Center for that big deal, and that's great. The smaller rodeos, I fear, I'll put it this way. We have three children. They're now in their late 20s and 30s, and so they were in school, you know, at the at the turn of the century. That's a right, weird thing to say. Yeah. But they didn't. They and their classmates, a very low percentage of them went to football and basketball games, and that really surprised me. When I was a kid in the 70s, everybody went to football games. Everybody went to basketball games. We weren't big sports fans, but that was where the social life happened. If you wanted to know where the party was, you went to the basketball game because the parties would be after. If you wanted to chase girls, you went to the basketball game. All of that doesn't happen any longer. It hasn't happened for a while, and I think that's high school sports. I think that's small rodeos. It's movies, for heaven's sakes. You know, you go to the movies now, and the parking lot's 80% empty at 7:30 on a Friday night. And so I fear the way that we're all getting out of the habit of going places and doing things. And and even in just the, you know, 15 years isn't a lot of time in one sense, the crowds are smaller. And so not for rodeo per se, but as an event that people attend, I think it's in the same trouble that high school sports and theater and a lot of other things are, which is a shame because I'll tell you, it is just the coolest thing to go there and sit in an arena and see that happen in front of your face and hear that noise and see all of that. You're missing out if you're missing that.
My first rodeo was in Hawaii, and a friend of mine was going to ride bull in the Marine Corps. And I was like, okay, I'll come watch. And I was so terrified. The adrenaline of being in that. I mean, it was intense. I was like, oh, this is serious stuff.
Yeah.
It only lasted about half a second for him, by the way, but it was his first try, so.
That's a half a second more than I would ever dare ride.
I would not have gotten, yeah, exactly.
Won't get any grief from me.
That's Jeremiah Murphy. You can find his photos online at the New Yorker. Search for the New Yorker photo booth or head to sdpb.org/news. We'll put a link up on our website. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by R. Youngman and Ellen Kester. I'm your host, Lori Walsh, from all of us here at SDPB. Thank you for listening.